systems, and governance, which are the building blocks of democracy. In today's world, you cannot get from Mao to Merrill Lynch without some Madison as well. Let's look in detail at how the herd is forcing in place some of these building blocks of democracy. Transparency. The Wall Street Journal reported that when senior finance officials from the United States, Japan, China, and 11 other Asian countries gathered for a meeting in Malaysia in November 1997, they found that the Malaysian Central Bank had put up an electronic scoreboard, the sort you usually find at an NBA basketball game, which displayed a running tally of Malaysia's currency reserves to reassure visitors about the soundness of the country's economy. Not every country is going to go so far as to put up such a scoreboard in the arrival terminal of their airport. Or maybe they will. In recent years, the electronic herd has learned, usually the hard way, to demand more transparency in financial reporting. Countries that plug into the herd have increasingly learned, also the hard way, that the more transparent they are about their financial data and transactions, the less likely the herd is to make a sudden stampede away from them. Think of the electronic herd as being like a herd of wildebeests grazing over a wide area of Africa. When a wildebeest on the edge of the herd sees something move in the tall, thick brush next to where it's feeding, that wildebeest doesn't say to the wildebeest next to it, "Gosh, I wonder if that's a lion moving around there in the brush." No way. That wildebeest just starts a stampede. And these wildebeests don't stampede for a mere 100 yards. They stampede to the next country and crush everything in their path. So, how do you protect your country from this? Answer, you cut the grass and clear away the brush, so that the next time the wildebeest sees something rustle in the grass, it thinks, "No problem, I see what it is, it's just a bunny rabbit." Or, if there is a lion approaching, the wildebeest has time to see it from afar and to move away gradually without causing a huge stampede. If not, at least it will have time to get the herd to come together in a way that will scare off the lion. What transparency does is get more information to the wildebeests faster. So whatever they want to do to save their skins, they can do in an orderly manner. In the world of finance, this can mean the difference between having your market take a little dip and having it nosedive into sustained losses that take months or years to recover from. When South Korea's economy got into trouble in December 1997, it was telling everyone that its foreign currency reserves were $30 billion, when in fact they were only $10 billion. And when the herd found that out, it just took off. At the same time, the Seoul government told the IMF that its total short-term borrowings from overseas were $50 billion. A week later, it announced that they were $100 billion. Oops. This sort of lack of transparency, notes Richard Medley, who does political risk analysis for finance houses, is what causes some of the worst stampedes. Lack of transparency, he argues, is precisely what allows optimistic illusionists and paranoid illusionists the maximum freedom to roam. Think of Thailand, Korea, or Russia in the early 1990s. In good times, the lack of transparency of their economies encouraged the optimistic illusionists to create a bubble by pumping more and more money into these countries, confident that they could provide the same high returns they did the year before, even though the early money may have gone into productive factories, and the later money was going into luxury condos and factories for which there was no demand. You can't really do serious analysis on opaque systems, argues Medley. You get the electronic herd into that sort of optimistic illusion about your country, and it will bid prices through the roof. The optimistic illusionist says, "Close your eyes and buy, and surely there will be water in the pool when you land." But that is very dangerous, because the same opaqueness that drives the optimistic illusionists to bid up prices to exaggerated levels also empowers the paranoid illusionists to bid them down to exaggerated levels when sentiment shifts. Because on the way down, all of the stories that you, as an optimistic illusionist, told yourself, all the assumptions you made about the country's foreign currency reserves or forward obligations, collapse. You go from believing everything to believing nothing. In fact, the paranoid illusionist believes more than nothing. He believes that there are hidden debts and off-the-books liabilities all over the place. Every herd has optimistic and paranoid illusionists, and if you give them the opportunity, they will exacerbate stampedes in and out. The electronic herd has taught that lesson to several countries in recent years. Today, South Korea's Ministry of Finance sends out an email to global investors detailing its currency reserves at the end of each business day, including, as best it can, private capital flows. The Koreans went from thinking that transparency is nothing to transparency is everything, one Wall Street fund manager told me. They would send us a daily weather report if we asked for it. Rick Johnston, who heads up Latin American investing for Offit Bank, a private New York bank, told me, "When I go down to Brazil, I tell them, I need to see everything. I tell them quite frankly, it's not for me. I'm your friend. I believe in you. But how can you help me convince the unbelievers?" And the unbelievers now tell us, "Unless you strip down and let me look everywhere, I am not going to give you any money, because you have a historical propensity to disappoint. No transparency, no money. Show me the money. I want to see your books upside down, in the sunlight and then in the moonlight." Every day now, I get polling data about all aspects of the Brazilian economy, and I get a fax at the end of the day with all the capital flows of Brazil on that day. I know what went on in their commercial account, what went on in their financial account, what went through at the official central bank rate, and what went through the parallel market for tourist transactions. This sheet comes from a local private firm with data provided from the Brazil Central Bank. I will invest more if I know what is in their piggy bank at all times, even though there are still risks, because with the right data, I have the ability to price the risks, and I can change my mind if those flows turn negative. Otherwise, I would be guessing about rumors, and that's how you go broke. And once you have committed yourself to that level of scrutiny by the herd, there is no going back, except at a huge price. Standards. If you were writing a history of the American capital markets, Treasury Secretary Larry Summers once observed, I would suggest to you that the single most important innovation shaping that capital market was the idea of generally accepted accounting principles. We need that internationally. It is a minor but not insignificant triumph of the IMF that in Korea somebody who teaches a night school class in accounting told me that he normally has 22 students in his winter term. And this year, 1998, he has 385. We need that at the corporate level in Korea. We need that at the national level. One reason why that Korean accounting class exploded in size might be that the herd, in the wake of the 1997-98 financial crisis in Southeast Asia, began demanding better, more uniform accounting standards everywhere. When the herd started looking more closely at many of the companies in South Korea, Thailand, or Indonesia, it found it could not make sense of them because there were no unified balance sheets that aggregated all the units and subunits of companies so that you could see all the assets and all the liabilities, not to mention all the off-book assets and liabilities. The more the herd goes around investing in factories or markets in different countries, and the more those countries want to enlist investment from the herd, and the more companies in those countries want to be listed on the stock exchanges of one of the major supermarkets, the more pressure they will all come under to abide by international financial reporting standards. Consider an example I came across in the December 1997 issue of United Airlines Hemispheres magazine, which carried a story about one of the fastest-growing software companies in the world, India's Infosys. The article noted the following: "The key to their success has been abandoning the third-world policies and practices that hobble many subcontinent companies and forging a connection to the first world that permits the utmost in customer convenience. We decided from the outset that there would be no blurring of corporate and private resources," says Narayana Murthy, the company's visionary founder and chairman. "This means that no one uses a company car for a personal errand, a radical break from traditional Indian business culture. Frequently in India, corporate officers make personal use of company assets. Company electricians work in executives' homes. Employees pick up their supervisors' children from school and babysit them. Corporate accounts finance purchases of homes. Employees put up with such practices because they have no choice. Nevertheless, they lead to growing alienation and a rebellious withdrawal of creative input. That doesn't happen at Infosys. Infosys is the first Indian company to announce audited annual results within a week of the close of the financial year, the first to publish quarterly audited financial statements, and the first to publish statements in compliance with U.S. generally accepted accounting principles and the disclosure requirements of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Its disclosure norms and accounting practices have set standards for others to emulate," states one analyst's report. This trend is being enhanced by Internet brokerage. "Online trading," said John T. Wall, president of NASDAQ International, "definitely intensifies the scrutiny on governments and companies for better governance. Once people can invest overseas or from overseas and are able to execute the trade through online trading, they want to know more about the companies. Then they want to know whether they can trust the information about the companies. Is the financial data compiled according to the international accounting standards? What is the quality of their corporate governance? This is going to drive the harmonization of tax and legal systems." Indeed, one of the things that was revealed by the 1997-98 Asian economic crisis was that most of the big five American accounting firms had audited the books of the big Asian financial houses that had failed in the crisis, audited them without raising any red flags about their troubles, according to a study by the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. The main reason for this lapse, according to a November 17, 1998 story in the New York Times, was that the big five firms did not apply the same detailed accounting rules and standards in Asia that they use in America. And the main reason for this was that most of the big accounting firms, such as PricewaterhouseCoopers or Ernst & Young, moved into Asia by taking over local accounting firms whose local clients insisted on weaker local accounting rules. Not anymore. The World Bank has asked the Big Five not to sign their names to any audit not done according to the Big Five's international accounting standards. If it was done by one of their local subsidiaries by local rules, it should be signed only by the local firm. And investors beware. The UN study said poor auditing did not cause the Asian economic crisis, but better auditing would have detected the rising problems sooner and made the crisis less severe. As we increasingly move into a world where the Internet defines commerce, this push for common global standards is going to become hugely intensified, for one very simple reason. From the minute you decide to do business on the Internet as a retailer or service provider, from the first moment you open your website, you are a global company, whether you are in India, Italy, or Indianapolis. To do business on the Internet is by definition to be global. Therefore, you have to think globally, and you have to think about what will appeal to and attract global buyers of whatever you are selling. and you'd better be able to assure customers that you can ship your goods in a timely and safe fashion, that their credit card number will be safe in your site, that money can be transferred according to international standards, laws, and best practices, and that all accounting and commercial issues will be dealt with according to international norms. The more business that is conducted over the Internet by more people from more different corners of the globe, the more it is going to harmonize how people do business in every corner of the globe, argues Bob Hormats, vice chairman of Goldman Sachs International. I got a taste of this on several levels while visiting Sri Lanka in late 1999. The morning I arrived, I drove from the airport 2 hours out of Colombo to visit one of Sri Lanka's top textile factories. The road to the factory was a single lane, where passing other cars and cows was a harrowing experience. The landscape was that of a tropical rainforest. Eventually, though, we reached the village of Panala, outside of which was this very modern textile factory, with freshly painted buildings, manicured lawns, and satellite downlinks. It looked like it had descended from Mars. The factory belonged to a Sri Lankan firm named Slimline that manufactured clothes for Victoria's Secret and Marks & Spencer. The factory was completely computerized and was soon to be linked by Internet to the Victoria's Secret chain to handle e-commerce. About 1,400 employees, mostly women ages 18 and older, worked on rows and rows of pneumatic sewing machines. Everyone wore a uniform, and pregnant women were identified by a red cap and expected to keep a slower pace. The factory was air-conditioned and was clean enough to eat off the floor. The workday was 8 hours, but intense, as each woman had to stitch so many garments per minute. Each assembly line was tracked by computer, and a certain average production had to be reached for the women to get their monthly bonuses. Wages were about $80 to $100 a month, including breakfast, and there was a waiting list for jobs. In terms of working conditions, this factory was world-class. Wages aside, I would let my own daughters work there. I asked the plant owner, Mahesh Shamalian, why the fancy factory? Why not a sweatshop? Wouldn't that be more lucrative for him? No, he explained, it wouldn't, because of globalution. The only way Sri Lanka can survive in the textile business against even lower-wage countries such as China and Brazil is if it moves up the quality ladder and produces better goods for big global brand-name retailers. Racing to the bottom with Bangladesh is a no-win game, he explained. The only way to build long-term relationships with the big global brands is to produce higher and higher quality products under better and better working conditions. Those brand retailers are now demanding not only better prices and quality, but better conditions for workers, explained Amalian. This is not because Victoria's Secret has suddenly become socially conscious, but because American consumers and college students have become more socially conscious as a result of some very high-profile anti-sweatshop campaigns. And these consumers are now telling stores that they do not want to be wearing goods made under sweatshop conditions. In other words, one of the big reasons working conditions have improved in Sri Lankan textile factories is not because Sri Lanka put up walls against globalization, but because in today's global economy, Sri Lankan manufacturers must tie themselves to big Western retailers to survive. And the more they do that, the more their factory standards have to meet the workplace norms being demanded by Western consumers. When the buyers from Victoria's Secret and the other big brands come through now, working conditions is one of the first things they ask about, said Amalian. They have to, because they have customers asking them about it. A few days after visiting the Slimline factory, I attended a breakfast with a group of young Internet entrepreneurs, several of whom complained that one reason their infant companies were not developing much software of their own yet was because there was no effective local copyright law to prevent anyone from stealing it. They also complained that Microsoft had refused to enter the Sri Lankan market because of the lack of an intellectual property law. At that point, Lalit B. Gamage, who headed Sri Lanka's state-run Institute of Information Technology, said bluntly that in order to attract Microsoft and other big global technology companies to Sri Lanka, the government was pushing through a new rigorous intellectual property law, and he promised the others at the table that it would be ready within a year. All I could think of as I listened to this discussion was that Bill Gates had no idea of the impact his company was having on this tiny country. Such globalution is not only happening in the developing world. Maybe the biggest example in the world today of globalution imposing standards from beyond was the European Union's decision to impose a single currency and financial standards, a single golden straitjacket, on all its members under a single central bank. For a country like Italy, which was renowned for its corrupt and inefficient government, the European Monetary Union, begun in 1999, was a godsend. It forced Italy to stay inside the golden straitjacket by subcontracting key government operations to the European Central Bank in Frankfurt. National Public Radio ran a report from Italy in 1997 about how Italians, after a generation of inept governments, had mismanaged their currency into monopoly money, were eager to let the EU run their country. An Italian corporate lawyer, Mario Abate, was quoted as saying, "One of the immediate effects of joining the euro is that of doing what I call in-house cleaning. It really is forcing the government to come to grips with its huge deficit, with its inflation and spending. They are forced to do so. And in doing so, naturally, there will be advantages to the economy, and I am very much in favor because of this." Abate added that most Italians would probably be quite happy to have their whole country run by European Union officials. There's little resentment in Italy toward the centers of European power in Brussels, Frankfurt, and Strasbourg. There's much more hostility toward Rome, concluded Abate, because Rome has been the center of crime for us. They've been stealing our money. We consider it stealing because they take it and don't give it back. Italy's finance minister, Vincenzo Visco, told the Italian newspaper La Repubblica on the day the single European currency came into being at the start of 1999 that the euro means that there will be less malevolent buffoonery on the part of Italian politicians and businesses who in the past had exhibited an abnormal quantity of illegal behavior. Monetary union, he added, means that we will no longer be able to settle for lower standards simply because it pleases us. Now that's a globalutionary talking. Corruption. If you want to see how the globalization system can affect corruption in a positive way, read the stories about the October 12, 1999 military coup in Pakistan. What happened? The coup was a classic power struggle among elites, driven in large part by politics. General Pervez Musharraf had been emboldened to make an incursion into Indian-controlled Kashmir, probably hoping that since both Pakistan and India had acquired nuclear weapons, the world would step in and compel some sort of settlement in Kashmir. He miscalculated. The world did not step in, and Pakistani forces got hammered by India. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif backed out of the Kashmiri conflict and sought to blame the fiasco on the military and to fire Musharraf. In the ensuing power struggle, Musharraf and the army ousted Sharif instead. An old story. What was new was what happened once Musharraf actually took over the reins of power. It was then that he had to face what was actually important to his people, which, guess what, wasn't Kashmir, but corruption. the massive corruption that had been tolerated by the Sharif government. So General Musharraf, instead of trying to legitimate himself as Pakistan's next leader by presenting himself as a Muslim nationalist standing up for Pakistan's territorial integrity, went a totally different route. He justified his takeover by presenting himself as Mr. Clean, who would root out corruption in Pakistan once and for all. General Musharraf even offered to disclose his tax returns to prove he was clean. He knew that he had to address two audiences, those in Pakistan who were fed up with all the sleaze, and those in the electronic herd who now controlled the resources he needed to get Pakistan growing again. When in the history of the world did a general take power and the first thing he vowed to do was disclose his tax returns? Instead of a purge of the left or the right, he pledged that his government was going to go after all debtors, tax evaders, and other financial scoundrels. The Washington Post reported, October 21, 1999, that a few days after the coup, Pakistan's largest private bank took out a front-page newspaper ad that read, "Attention, all loan defaulters. Last chance. Pay up or face the consequences." I kept asking myself, was this a coup by Pakistan's military, or was this a coup by Pakistan's IRS? This was no anomaly. Globalution is creating a much higher cost for any country that tolerates corruption, if for no other reason than that in a world where people have so many investing options, why bother investing in country X, where you have to pay off everyone and his uncle, when you can go to country Y, get the same labor rates, and not have to pay off anybody? The electronic herd says to every country, if you cannot provide us a stable pool of customers and a secure set of opportunities for investments, fine, we will go elsewhere. And in a world without walls, there are now a lot of places to go. For the herd, corruption is just another name for unpredictability, because any deal can be undone by someone bribing someone, and there is nothing the herd hates more. Derek Shearer, who served as U.S. ambassador to Finland in the mid-1990s, saw firsthand how globalution is increasingly forcing Russians to choose between getting their corruption under control or remaining poor and underdeveloped forever. As U.S. ambassador in Finland, it was my job to go around to Finnish business leaders and encourage them to invest in Russia, on the argument that this was the best way to produce stability across the border from them, said Ambassador Shearer. But these Finns would say back to me, sure, we'll do business with the Russians. They can bring their trucks in here and fill them up with whatever they want, as long as they bring a bag of cash to pay for it. But we're not going over there to do business. It's way too corrupt and dangerous. And why should we? We can go to Hungary or Estonia or the Czech Republic and make money and be assured of being able to get our profits out. Why should we bother with Russia in the condition it's in? I would say, yes, yes, but you should think about investing there for regional stability. And they would just give me a blank stare. Well, now I'm out of government, and I am advising several investment firms on Wall Street. They were asking me the other day about investing in Russia, and I just told them, no way. If I look at it not from a policymaker's point of view, but from a businessman's point of view, you would be crazy to invest in Russia now. The Finns had it right. Sometimes the herd's imposition of higher standards can come as a huge shock to even the most advanced economies. Consider the February 20th, 1999 Washington Post article from Tokyo, headlined, "Japanese lawmaker hangs self in hotel." The lead of the story explained that Shokei Arai, the Japanese lawmaker at the center of a growing corruption scandal, committed suicide in his Tokyo hotel room just hours before he was about to be arrested. Deep in the story, though, were buried two very telling points. there is concern among some politicians that Arai may have left evidence incriminating others. There was no indication that Arai had left such documents, but at a press conference on Wednesday evening, he did complain that he had been unfairly singled out by prosecutors. Arai told reporters that Nico Securities assured him it had provided profits in a similar way to hundreds of other customers. Japanese businessmen say privately that they are stunned by the swift way in which what is permissible in the business culture here has changed. Once bureaucrats expected to be lavishly wined and dined, and companies openly participated in such activities, where it was said that bureaucrats and businessmen could informally exchange necessary information. VIP accounts and racketeer payoffs were also an open secret, say businessmen, and prosecutors ignored those activities until recently. Political commentator Minoru Morita attributes the tougher attitude to a new group of younger, more aggressive prosecutors who were trained overseas. They are beginning to think like Westerners and see the Japanese tradition of lavish entertainment of government officials as way beyond internationally accepted standards, Morita said. Robert Shapiro, chairman of Monsanto, once remarked to me that his company is not on a crusade for spreading anti-corrupt practices, but not paying bribes is how it does its own business, and he is keenly aware that in doing so, Monsanto is helping to seed the world with people who share its values. We hire a lot of people now in a lot of foreign countries, and we become kind of a finishing school for them, remarked Shapiro. A lot of people who join us abroad have trouble believing that we are serious about this anti-corruption stuff, and that we really are not going to make a contribution to the local warlords. To be sure, there have been and always will be exceptions, especially as global competition becomes more intense, and therefore the temptation to chase after questionable business will increase. According to a U.S. congressional study, Citibank was so eager to do business with Raul Salinas de Gortari, brother of the former president of Mexico, that the bank ignored its own safeguards and helped him move some $100 million in illicit funds out of Mexico in a way that disguised the destination and origin of the funds. For now, though, these cases remain just that, exceptions. The dominant international trend is clearly in the other direction. The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, passed in 1977, makes it illegal for American companies to pay bribes to advance foreign business deals. On November 20, 1997, the 29-nation Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, which comprises the world's leading industrial democracies, agreed to adopt much of America's anti-corruption legislation. Under the new OECD regulations, European and Japanese firms will be banned from bribing foreign officials to win contracts, and it should also be harder for these firms to write off bribes as tax deductions, which was legal in both France and Germany. While there are still some loopholes in this new legislation, it marks a victory for the American bulls in the electronic herd, who argued that they were losing billions of dollars in contracts because of payoffs by Europeans and Japanese. Free press. China's going to have a free press. Globolution will drive it. Oh, China's leaders don't know it yet, but they are being pushed straight in that direction. Just look at what happened in the last 2 weeks of December 1996. During 1996, the two hottest stock markets in Asia were in China, the Shanghai and Shenzhen stock exchanges. Between April 1st and December 9th, Shanghai's composite index was up 120%, while Shenzhen's was up 315%. One reason these two stock markets were so hot was that they were virtually unregulated, and one reason they were so unregulated was that China has only the most rudimentary securities and exchange system. and it has virtually no independent, responsible, uncorrupted financial press that can credibly highlight the quality stocks and brutally expose those flim-flam Chinese companies that don't report timely, accurate, or transparent financial data. Barron's, Fortune, Business Week, the Far Eastern Economic Review, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal play that watchdog role all the time. In December 1996, China's government realized the Shanghai and Shenzhen markets were out of control because of all sorts of wild speculation and unsavory trading practices, but its tools for dealing with this were limited to one sledgehammer, the state-owned press. So on December 16, 1996, the People's Daily, China's official paper, published a blaring editorial warning that stock prices had been pushed to irrational and abnormal levels. Guess what happened? Everyone tried to sell at once. Both markets plunged, and a lot of little investors got hurt. So many that police had to keep order among furious investors who staged protests outside brokerage houses in several major Chinese cities. The Asian Wall Street Journal reported that outside a brokerage house in Beijing, a worker groused that he'd lost 20,000 yuan, about $2,400, so far this week. Before the People's Daily opened its mouth, there was a balance between buying and selling, a man in a leather jacket declared, to shouts of approval from dozens of other investors. After that, nobody has dared buy. The market is sinking. The angriest person in the world is not someone who has lost his job. The angriest person in the world is someone who feels cheated out of the savings earned from his job. Over time, China's leaders simply can't control and monitor their bursting free markets or prevent little people from getting cheated and then rioting against the government without the other institutions that must go with free markets, from an effective SEC to a free and responsible press backed by the rule of law. In a word, globalution. It is not an accident that the Southeast Asian nation that has the freest press, Taiwan, was also the Southeast Asian nation that suffered the least economic setback in the 1997-98 Asian downturn. Already 30 million Chinese own stock. With so many new shareholders, a lot of underground stock-oriented newspapers and magazines have sprung up, because investors are demanding real economic news. They start out as sort of tip sheets put out by the research offices of various brokerage houses and then are faxed around town, explained Seth Fison, the New York Times bureau chief in Shanghai. It is all market-oriented news about different companies or stocks, or it may be a tip about what a ministry in Beijing is going to do. A lot of it is just rumors, some of which turn out to be true. It is geared for an audience of people who are playing the markets but don't feel they are getting enough news out of the daily papers. But what happens is that once the Chinese government tells the press they are free to write about business, newspapers like China's Southern Weekend use that opening to cram in all sorts of quasi-political news and criticism about corruption and political abuses by officials on the business pages. That is how a free press will get born in China. Bond and stock markets. There are essentially three ways that businesses can raise money: by borrowing from a bank, by selling shares on a stock market, and by issuing bonds on a bond market. It is very important for a country to have all three options. So if your banks get into trouble, entrepreneurs can turn to the bond and stock markets. And if the bond market tanks, they can turn to the stock market and banks. This so-called three-legged approach disperses risks more widely and enhances any financial system's ability to cope with shocks. All too often, though, developing countries just have one or, at best, two legs of this three-legged stool, and that makes their financial systems less than stable. Look at the Asian tigers. What they had in common when their economic crises hit was that each had very high levels of saving. Oh, developing countries just have one or at best two legs of this three-legged stool, and that makes their financial systems less than stable. Look at the Asian tigers. What they had in common when their economic crises hit was that each had very high levels of savings and very low levels of government debt. The people didn't spend, and the government didn't borrow. Good news, right? Not necessarily. While these countries had all these people who loved to save, the only place they could put their money, for the most part, was in local banks, because mutual funds, pension funds, and local bond markets were either non-existent or highly underdeveloped. So what happened was that local banks built up huge cash balances. The only thing they could do with all these savings was lend them back to local companies. This led to fierce competition between local banks and contributed to banks throwing money at less and less qualified borrowers for less and less qualified projects. Moreover, when the banks went bad or had to be restructured in a country such as Thailand, it was very difficult for businesses to raise fresh capital because it had no bond market and its stock market was in the tank. No wonder that Singapore and Hong Kong deliberately created bond markets, even though there was plenty of local capital around through bank savings, because they wanted a local bond market that would provide patient capital, that is, long-term financing for corporate borrowers so that they would not be subject to the vagaries of short-term lending from banks. In addition, a bond market also gave Singapore and Hong Kong savers the chance to buy higher-yielding mutual funds and pension funds as an alternative to bank savings accounts for investing. The electronic herd has long encouraged the creation of bond markets, both for its own appetites and because of how well-regulated bond and stock markets contribute to greater financial democratization and transparency. Bond and stock markets liberate entrepreneurs from having to cultivate relationships with just a handful of bankers in order to raise cash. Also, when companies are totally dependent on borrowing from banks, particularly in crony capitalist operating systems where the bankers are tied in with the companies and high bureaucrats, they can avoid a lot of the scrutiny that they would have to undergo if they were issuing bonds or stocks. Companies that issue stocks and bonds have their performance judged every day. Their bonds are held by a diverse public and rated by independent rating agencies, while the stocks are traded by anonymous investors on an open market. The only way your corporate bond can be rated or your stock listed in a properly regulated market is through proper disclosure. And if you are appealing to international investors and want to be rated by a Moody's or Duff & Phelps credit rating company or Standard & Poor's, that disclosure will have to be based on international norms. Punishment is swift for any deviance. Consider this November 15, 1998 Washington Post report from Paris. The story begins with Serge Churuc, one of the best-known business executives in France, telling a breakfast meeting of big international investors that profits for his company, Alcatel, the French telecommunications giant, would be considerably lower than the company had forecast just a few weeks earlier. The herd does not like such surprises. Between the end of that breakfast and the close of business that day, Alcatel's stock fell 38%, the largest one-day decline ever on the French stock exchange, as primarily American and British pension and mutual funds left Alcatel for dead. The Post reporter, Anne Swartzen, then went on to note how the herd was reshaping the old ways of Europe, Inc. In the past few years, foreigners have pushed many companies to change management, reform accounting systems, initiate international mergers, inject English, the language of international commerce, into the boardroom. In general, European management, historically uninterested in shareholders' demands, have become more responsive and attentive. What I enjoyed most, though, was reading that the day after the herd stampeded Alcatel's stock, Chirouk got on a plane and flew to London, then hopped the Concorde for New York to meet with his American mutual fund investors, to try to explain to them what went wrong and win back their confidence. He was apologetic, but it didn't matter, one U.S. participant told the Post. By then, we had sold all our shares. Democratization. The electronic herd will intensify pressures for democratization, generally, for three very critical reasons: flexibility, legitimacy, and sustainability. Here's how. The faster and bigger the herd gets, the more greased and open the global economy becomes, the more flexibility you need to get the most out of the herd and protect yourself from it. While one can always find exceptions, I still believe that as a general rule, the more democratic, accountable, and open your governance, the less likely it is that your financial system will be exposed to surprises. And when it is exposed to shocks and surprises, the more quickly it can adjust to changing circumstances and demands. Also, the more open and democratic your society, the more feedback you are always going to be getting, the better chance you have to make mid-course corrections before you go over a cliff, and the easier it is to bring in new managers and to kick out inept ones. Moreover, as your country has to make these often painful mid-course corrections, the more democratic it is, the more legitimacy your government will have to share the pain of reform with the whole population. Think of what the Southeast Asian leaders were telling their people for most of the post-World War II era, says democracy scholar Larry Diamond. They were telling their people, "You give me your freedom and keep your mouth shut, and I will give you the opportunity to get rich." It was easy for people to be apolitical when all boats were rising, and people felt that they could leave political management to someone else without harming their economic well-being. Well, that worked fine for about 30 years, but then the growth collapsed, and the distribution of riches, welfare, and benefits collapsed too, and people realized that they could not leave politics to someone else. So the bargain breaks down. As a result, what the people have said to their governments in Thailand, Indonesia, Korea, and soon will in China, is that if you have taken away our growth, if the state cannot deliver on the previous bargain, then we want a new bargain. And in this bargain, we are going to have a much bigger say in how the system operates. But because we have a bigger say, we will be ready to make bigger sacrifices while the system is reformed and gets up to speed. And that is why they are ready to exhibit considerably more patience in the face of economic suffering than many people expected. Because their politics has been opened and democratized, they at least have more of a feeling that they are working through these problems with a degree of equality. They become part owners of the game. Of those Asian nations that were fully plugged into the electronic herd, China, without a convertible currency and open capital markets, is not fully plugged in yet. Those with the most non-corrupt and democratic systems, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, were hurt the least by the 1997 downturn. Those countries which had democratic but corrupt systems, Thailand and Korea, were hurt the second worst. But because they were democracies, they were able to respond quickly to the crisis, without popular uprisings, by voting in better governance and software. After having been just hammered by the electronic herd in the fall of 1997, Thailand elected the cleanest, most democratic party in the country and passed a radical new anti-corruption constitution. The new Thai constitution mandated for the first time that Thai politicians would have to declare their personal assets before and after leaving office and would be subject to impeachment if more than 50,000 voters signed a petition seeking a corruption investigation into their affairs. Thailand also passed the first Freedom of Information Act in Asia, which the Thai press is now aggressively using to monitor Thai ministers as never before. As a World Bank official in Bangkok observed to me, "The new constitution never would have been passed through Parliament without the banking crisis. Never. The banking crisis got both the king and the army to push it after they had been hesitant before." How did Korea react? By electing the most liberal Democrat in the country, Kim Dae-jung, a man who could not get elected dog catcher before Korea's financial crisis. The Southeast Asian country that was the most authoritarian and the most corrupt, Indonesia under Suharto, was the one that was least flexible, least capable of adopting new software, and the one that eventually melted down, because the Indonesian masses were not ready to share the pain of reforms, because they did not feel the government was their own. When the Indonesian currency got hammered in 1998 and the IMF would give bailout loans only if Indonesia cut spending, President Suharto had to say to his people, "Friends, we've got to tighten our belts. We're all in this together." And when he tried that, the answer he got back from his own people in an explosion of rage was, "Mr. President, we all weren't in the toll roads and hotels and airlines and taxi companies you and your children owned together. So screw you." Finally, it is one thing for a government to improve its operating system and software on paper, but the only way to make sure those improvements are sustainable is to firmly locate them within a democratic or democratizing system. As Diamond puts it, "Nations that try to plug into the herd with good software, rule of law, and accountability, but with no regular free elections, will not be able to keep up with the herd in the long run, because you cannot sustain good software with an authoritarian regime that is not itself accountable, does not permit the free flow of information, does not permit an independent judiciary to pursue corruption, and does not permit free elections so that the political management can be changed." Elections alone will never be enough to ensure good governance. Russia and Pakistan are proof enough of that. At the same time, just installing modern operating systems and software in a country without holding regular elections that can remove corrupt leaders will never be effective either. That is why the wisest leaders in developing countries will be those who understand quickest that without the herd, there will be no growth, and without better software and operating systems, there will be no herd. And without regular elections, there will be no long-term better governance. While the logic of globalution leaves me an optimist that the herd will make an increasingly important contribution to democratization, the reality of how it will unfold has to leave you cautious. You don't just plug into the herd and get better software, operating systems, and democracy on the other end. You have to work at it. Building software is an inherently political process involving real human beings that often runs into political, economic, historical, and cultural resistance. There are no shortcuts, and people almost always have to learn the hard way. America got where it is today thanks to 200 years of boom and bust cycles in the railroad business, endless bank failures, huge bankruptcies, monopolies created and busted up, the stock market crash of 1929, and the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s. We weren't born this way. I once asked Anatoly Chubais, the architect of many of Russia's halting economic reforms, about how difficult it was for Russia to move to a free market system. "We did not have enough people with experience in modern governing or technologies or markets because we had no markets," he answered. The very word market was prohibited in the Soviet Union. "I am not an old man, but I do remember a friend of mine, an economist, who in 1982 lost his job for writing an article in a scientific journal where he used the word market." And here's what's really scary. Even when you figure out what a market is, even when you build better software, improving it is a never-ending task. What happens when you get Das Kapital 6.0? You get to start working on Das Kapital 7.0. Julia Preston, the New York Times correspondent in Mexico City, once told me of an unusual meeting of the Zapatista guerrillas, the peasant group that has been fighting the effects of free trade and globalization on Mexico. The Zapatistas held a convention in the jungle of southern Mexico entitled The Intercontinental Forum in Favor of Humanity and Against Neoliberalism. The closing session met in a steamy mudhole amphitheater and was presided over by Zapatista leader Subcommander Marcos, a Mexican combination of Robin Hood and Ralph Nader. The session ended with the Zapatistas doing a kind of drum roll and announcing the most evil, dangerous institution in the world today. To a standing ovation, the Zapatistas declared the biggest enemy of mankind to be the WTO, the World Trade Organization in Geneva, which promotes global free trade and an end to protectionism. Now, that story always reminded me of the fact that while the electronic herd and the supermarkets will be important contributors to democratization, they will also create the opposite effect. They will contribute to a widespread feeling, particularly within democracies, that even if people have a democracy at home, they have lost control over their lives, because even their elected representatives have to bow now to unelected market dictators. The bigger, faster, and more influential the herd becomes, argues Wharton School globalization expert Stephen J. Cobran, the more individual citizens start to feel that the locus of economic control and political decision-making on economic matters is shifting from the local level, where it can be controlled, to the global level, where no one is in charge and no one is minding the store. When all politics is local, your vote matters. But when the power shifts to these transnational spheres, there are no elections and there is no one to vote for. There is no question that in the globalization system, where power is now more evenly shared between states and supermarkets, a certain degree of decision-making is moved out of each country's political sphere into the global market sphere, where no one person, country, or institution can exert exclusive political control. At least not yet. Think how many times you've heard the expression, "The markets say," "The markets are demanding that," "The markets were not happy." As Israeli political theorist Yaron Ezrahi notes, the most arbitrary powers in history always hid under the claim of some impersonal logic, God, the laws of nature, the laws of the market, and they always provoked a backlash when morally intolerable discrepancies became glaringly visible. The Enlightenment was really the globalization of science and rationality, and the backlash came when every thief, crook, exploiter, and fraud claimed that whatever he was doing was necessitated by science and logic. The same could happen with globalization. Many will see it as little more than a mask used by certain economic elites for taking away the voice of the individual citizen. That is why some argue that the globalizers in each society want to buy the media first, because they want to turn potentially aggrieved and assertive citizens into conforming consumers. Turning politics into a spectator sport is one of the subtle processes which supports globalization. It converts or transforms the citizen from an actor to a spectator, with illusions of participation. The more citizens begin to feel that in this new system of globalization, things are controlled from afar, not from at home, the more the globalizers in these countries will be exposed to attacks. Egypt's Minister of Economy, Youssef Boutros Ghali, once observed, "The whole process of globalization is very easy to demagogue. Those who want to resist change point to anyone who wants to open the economy for foreign investment and say, "Look, here is a man who is a traitor to our cause because he wants to open the system to foreigners." And then you say, "Yes, but it is more efficient to let markets determine prices." And they come back at you and say, "Are you crazy? Markets are determined by foreigners. How can we let our markets determine prices when markets are controlled by foreigners?" Clearly, one of the biggest challenges for political theory in this globalization era is how to give citizens a sense that they can exercise their will, not only over their own governments, but over at least some of the global forces shaping their lives. Because market forces and institutions are ethically indifferent, they require a deliberative communal intelligence to prevent extreme injustices, says Ezrahi. That deliberative role is the essence of citizenship and democratic governance, guarding and shaping the public space and collective life. And you really have a problem if your public space and collective life are being shaped by forces beyond your own politics. Our children's civics classes will have to go beyond the study of local, state, and national governments into the realm of studying what is acceptable conduct in the relations between states and supermarkets, between states and super-empowered individuals, and between super-empowered individuals and supermarkets. How do we deal with a world where the electronic herd gets to vote in all kinds of countries every day, but those countries don't get to vote on the herd's behavior in such a direct and immediate manner? Who will govern relations between me and my internet, and between the supermarkets and me, and between my government and the supermarkets? To paraphrase Larry Summers, this is the globalization trilemma. The one thing you can say in favor of the globalization system is that it doesn't discriminate. It leaves both the weak and the powerful feeling a loss of control and under the thumb of unelected and at times uncontrollable forces. I went to see Mexico's finance minister, Guillermo Ortiz, immediately after the 1995 crash of the Mexican peso. He was sitting at his desk, tied to his computer screens, which were charting the second-by-second fall of the peso like an EKG heading for a heart attack. "Give us a truce," said Ortiz, addressing the global markets. "You have pounded us to death. Stop selling us short." When I asked him what it was like to be caught in the maw of the global markets, which were chasing him with a golden straitjacket, Ortiz gestured to the three computer screens next to his desk that tracked the peso second by second. "I have days when I feel absolutely powerless. Sometimes I have to go to work in the other room so that I can concentrate away from the screens." Chapter 10. Shapers, Adapters, and Other New Ways of Thinking About Power. Redmond, Washington, October 21st, 1997. In direct response to accusations made by the Department of Justice, the Microsoft Corporation announced today that it will be acquiring the federal government of the United States of America for an undisclosed sum. "It's actually a logical extension of our planned growth," said Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates. "It really is going to be a positive arrangement for everyone." Microsoft representatives held a briefing in the Oval Office of the White House with U.S. President Bill Clinton and assured members of the press that changes will be minimal. The United States will be managed as a wholly owned division of Microsoft. An initial public offering is planned for July of next year, and the federal government is expected to be profitable by the fourth quarter 1999 at the latest, according to Microsoft President Steve Ballmer. In a related announcement, Bill Clinton stated that he had willingly and enthusiastically accepted a position as a vice president with Microsoft and will continue to manage the United States government, reporting directly to Bill Gates. When asked how it felt to give up the mantle of executive authority to Gates, Clinton smiled and referred to it as a relief. He went on to say that Gates has a proven track record and that U.S. citizens should offer Gates their full support and confidence. Clinton will reportedly be earning several times the $200,000 annually he has earned as U.S. president in his new role at Microsoft. Gates dismissed a suggestion that the U.S. Capitol be moved to Redmond as silly, though he did say that he would make executive decisions for the U.S. government from his existing office at Microsoft headquarters. Gates went on to say that the House and Senate would, of course, be abolished. Microsoft isn't a democracy, he observed, and look how well we're doing. When asked if the rumored attendant acquisition of Canada was proceeding, Gates said, "We don't deny that discussions are taking place." Microsoft representatives closed the conference by stating that United States citizens will be able to expect lower taxes, increases in government services, and discounts on all Microsoft products. About Microsoft. Founded in 1978, Microsoft, NASDAQ MSFT, is the worldwide leader in software for personal computers and democratic government. The company offers a wide range of products and services for public, business, and personal use, each designed with the mission of making it easier and more enjoyable for people to take advantage of the full power of personal computing and free society every day. About the United States. Founded in 1789, the United States of America is the most successful nation in the history of the world, and has been a beacon of democracy and opportunity for over 200 years. Headquartered in Washington, D.C., the United States is a wholly owned subsidiary of Microsoft Corporation. Anonymous spoof of Microsoft that appeared on the Internet. I was reading the Financial Times one day in the fall of 1995 when a front-page picture jumped out at me. It showed Bill Gates, the chairman of Microsoft, holding talks with Jiang Zemin, the president of China. The caption was written as though this were a standard summit meeting between two world leaders. It said the two men held very cordial talks, in contrast with their frosty meeting 18 months earlier. I thought to myself, Bill Gates has met Jiang Zemin twice in 18 months. That's once more than Bill Clinton has met the Chinese leader. That was no accident. The Chinese seemed to believe at the time that they needed Bill G more than they needed Bill C. And who could blame them? The Chinese were upset that the Chinese language translation of Windows 3.1 was done by Taiwanese computer linguists using Taiwanese-style Chinese characters and computer codes. Nothing could possibly enrage China more than the thought of Taiwan shaping the software and operating systems for every Chinese computer. As a result, the Beijing authorities were blocking market access for Windows 95 until Microsoft agreed that the Chinese version of that software would be jointly produced by Microsoft and a mainland Chinese company. Reading that story and studying that caption started me wondering whether the attributes of countries and companies weren't starting to converge. After all, if it's right that when you link your country up with the global economy, it's like taking your country public, like turning your country into a public company with shareholders all over the world, this alone is giving countries more of a corporate feel. Citizens are behaving more like shareholders, leaders more like management, and foreign policy analysts more like credit rating agencies. At the same time, the more widespread the Internet becomes in the lives of citizens, the more they are going to put pressure on their governments and legal systems to operate at net speed. In the Cold War system, the gap between companies and governments existed, but it wasn't huge. IBM and General Motors operated a lot like the federal government or even the Kremlin. Not anymore, which is why the demand for e-government is rising. Why should you wait in line for 6 hours at the County License Bureau to get your license renewed when you can buy the whole bloody car online? More and more citizens will expect the same ease of service from the United States of America as they get from America Online. When we all know how each other lives, governments increasingly have to promise the same things. And when we all know how each other shops, governments increasingly are going to have to deliver the same services with the same ease. And the only way governments will be able to do that is by operating more like good companies. To put it another way, the more people want government to become as quick and efficient as Amazon.com, the more government has to operate like Amazon.com. Moreover, countries are under pressure to behave more like companies because in the globalization system, countries, more than ever, can choose prosperity, depending on the policies they adopt, and their citizens will start to catch on to that and demand better management accordingly. As people become increasingly aware that their government is running Das Kapital 1.0, while the government next door is running Das Kapital 6.0, they will start to ask, why? People will learn that unlike in the Industrial Revolution, countries today don't have to be prisoners of their natural resources, geography, or history. In today's globalization system, any country can plug into the Internet, import knowledge, and develop its own educational base. Any country can find shareholders from any other country to invest in its infrastructure. Any country with the right leadership can implement Das Kapital 6.0 over a period of time. Which will be the world's fastest growing economy this year? Asked the Economist Intelligence Unit in early 2000. Mozambique. Mozambique has been one of the world's fastest-growing economies for the past 4 years. GDP growth there has averaged 10%. Botswana has enjoyed average growth of 7% over that period. Despite Africa's disadvantages, such as climate and disease, some political stability, prudent fiscal policies, and business-friendly reforms can work wonders, even in desperately poor countries. Mozambique and Botswana chose prosperity. As Harvard Business School professor Michael Porter once put it, a nation's wealth is now principally of its own collective choosing. Location, natural resources, and even military might are no longer decisive. Instead, how a nation and its citizens choose to organize and manage the economy, the institutions they put in place, and the types of investments they individually and collectively choose to make will determine national prosperity. If countries can now choose prosperity just like companies, what are the policies and skills countries should adopt in this era of globalization? What follows, over this chapter and the next, is my own checklist developed from looking at the best global companies and countries. When I come into a country today, these are the first two questions I ask when trying to assess its economic power and potential. How wired is your country or company? In October 1995, I flew out to Redmond, Washington, to interview Microsoft's number two man, President Steve Ballmer, in order to ask him one simple question. Microsoft is the most important company in America today, so how does Microsoft measure power in its universe? When it looks out on the world, which countries strike it as powerful today, and why? Ballmer had a simple answer back in October 1995. We measure power in one ratio, PCs per household, he said. Okay, I answered, then give me your power map of the world. Well, he said, the fastest growing region for Microsoft was Asia, where South Korea had the highest density of PCs per household. Japan was just taking off, he said, but Microsoft was most excited about China. How can you like China? I asked. People make $50 a month there. Oh, you don't understand, Ballmer answered. He then went over to a blackboard and drew two short lines together on one side, two short lines on the other side, two short lines under both of them, and one line at the bottom. "What's that?" I asked. He then circled each pair of lines at the top and then the pair of lines under them, and then the last line at the bottom, and said, "That is two Chinese maternal grandparents and two Chinese paternal grandparents and two Chinese parents, all saving for the Windows 95 for one Chinese kid." Yes, even birth control in China works for Microsoft. "Keep going around the world," I said. Brazil and India were both hot, with rapid growth in PCs per household, Ballmer said. But the Middle East was pretty much a black hole for Microsoft, from Morocco to the border of Pakistan, with the exception of Israel, which had its own Microsoft Development Center, a whole different level of power, and Saudi Arabia, where Egyptians were running Microsoft for multinationals. Western Europe was strong everywhere, Ballmer indicated, except one country, France. "I don't want to say France has fallen behind," said Ballmer, "but the penetration of PCs relative to population was quite high in France. That's not true anymore." I called Ballmer's power map Foreign Policy 3.1. 3 years later, in 1998, I decided I should update it. This time, though, I decided to go to Silicon Valley and ask the top managers at the leading companies there, Intel, Sun, and Cisco, as well as professors at the Stanford University School of Engineering, how they measured power. Interestingly, I discovered things had evolved considerably. Silicon Valley, they explained, measured power in 1998, not just by PCs per household anymore, but by degree of connectivity. "The important thing now," they said, "is how broadly and deeply your country has taken its PCs and linked them together into networks within companies, schools, and entertainment sources, and then tied those intranets into the Internet and the World Wide Web. Degree of connectivity is usually measured by how extensive is a country's bandwidth, the capacity of its cable, telephone lines, and fiber optics to carry digital communications, all those packets of ones and zeros, from point to point within networks. If the mantra of the PC decade, the 1980s, was, you can never have too much memory in your computer, the mantra of the post-PC decade, the network era, is, you can never have too much bandwidth in your country. The more installed bandwidth your country has, the greater its degree of connectivity. If you want to know just how connected a country is, you measure its megabits per capita, how much installed bandwidth it has divided by the number of its potential users. Megabits per capita has now joined PCs per household as a key yardstick of power in the Silicon universe. It will tell you the rate of information dissemination within the population and to and from decision makers. Jobs, knowledge use, and economic growth will gravitate to those societies that are the most connected, with the most networks and the broadest amount of bandwidth. Because these countries will find it easiest to amass, deploy, and share knowledge in order to design, invent, manufacture, sell, provide services, communicate, educate, and entertain. Connectivity is now productivity. As Brian Reed, a Digital Equipment Corporation executive who did some of the pioneering work on the Internet, once told the New York Times, December 8, 1997, "Bandwidth is the delivery system by which companies sell their goods in the information age. Bandwidth in the late 1990s is important for commerce in the same way that railroads were important in the 1890s and seaports were in the 1790s. It's the way you sell your product." John Chambers of Cisco likes to say that the companies and countries who will thrive in this Internet economy are those who will grasp its importance first and get wired before the rest of the world realizes that they have to change. If you do that faster than your competitors, says Chambers, there's only one thing you'll have to say to them. Game over. Because as we rapidly move into a world in which the Internet will define commerce, education, and communication, there will be just two kinds of businesses. Internet businesses and anti-Internet businesses. Internet businesses are those that can either be done over the Internet, everything from book selling to brokerage to gambling, or be significantly enhanced by the Internet, which applies to everything from management consulting to inventory control.